This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. A few years ago, a student of Chris Benthy's walked into his office, and like him, she was from a small Quaker town of Richmond, Indiana. And they talked about the old rundown bookstore that really doesn't sell books anymore and the restaurant downtown that really doesn't sell food. And they also talked about the explosion of 1968 that killed more than 40 people and injured more than 150. A few weeks later, that student sent Chris a photo of the monument the town of Richmond put up in the memory of those innocent victims. This seemingly small event was the impetus for Chris's new book, Red Brick, Black Mountain, White Clay. The family memoir tells the stories of his ancestors' work as bricklayers, his father's escape from Nazi Germany, his great aunt and uncle's founding of Black Mountain College, and it all takes place in North Carolina. Chris Benthy is a professor of English at Mount Holyoke College. His new book called Red Brick, Black Mountain, White Clay, and he joins us now. Welcome, Chris. Good to talk with you.
Hey, pleasure to be here. Thanks.
So let's talk about the impetus for this book is the memory of that 1968 explosion in Richmond, Indiana. You witnessed that as a young man. Tell me about that.
Well, I was walking home from playing quartets downtown in Richmond, Indiana, and suddenly there was an unbelievably loud explosion, and a mushroom cloud appeared over the little town of Richmond, Indiana, as though somebody had dropped an atomic bomb on it. I was a teenager at the time, and it shook something loose in me, and it shook something loose in the town of Richmond. It was also 1968, when the whole United States seemed to be up in flames with assassinations and riots. And somehow the memory of that moment in 1968 drove a kind of retrospective engine in me. Yeah. And the book really erupted out of that, looking back to that moment.
A mushroom cloud. It was some explosion. Tell us about what it is that caused that explosion and the story behind it.
Well, the rumor was that local white people who were afraid there would be race riots in our little town of Richmond, Indiana, after the assassination of Martin Luther King, were stockpiling gunpowder downtown, and there was a gas leak. So instead of blowing up the people they regarded as their enemies, Richmond, Indiana blew up its own innocent citizens. It's hard to capture the sheer craziness and paranoia of the 1960s, but that's the world that baby boomers like me grew up in.
Paranoia, preparation for a race war in a town in Indiana, but this is primarily a Quaker town, or a town inhabited largely by Quakers, right?
That's the irony of it, almost a professionally Quaker town with a Quaker college, Earlham College, where my father taught. But I think alternative lifestyles like the Quakers had always established tend to divide people between those who believe and those who don't. And a lot of the book takes up that theme that in difficult times, contentious times, innovative and creative people want to try something new. A lot of the stories in the book, and the book is made up of a lot of different family stories, have to do with creative responses to explosions of various kinds, both literal and figural.
Well, let's talk about some of those and how your family came together. The man, your father, the man your mother would marry, has a story of his own. He had to escape from Nazi Germany. So tell us about his story and how you ended up in Richmond.
That's right. My father grew up in a very well-to-do German-Jewish family and Berlin. His father was a Supreme Court judge, very wealthy family. And in 1933, kids like my father were suddenly enemies of the state. He grew up in England with a foster family, separated from his own family for 10 years, and eventually came to the United States as a young chemistry professor. My mother came from a completely different world. She was from rural North Carolina, from a little town called Cameron, not too far from Sanford and Southern Pines, near Raleigh. And she had come to Guilford College, the same little Quaker college in Greensboro where I went to school and where much later my father was a professor. Anyway, my mother and my father met at Haverford, yet another Quaker college, and fell in love. My mother was herself recovering from an unbelievable tragedy at the time. Just a couple of weeks before she graduated from Guilford College, the young man she was in love with at the time, a half-Russian, very exotic young Quaker called Sergei, Sergei went out to practice his canoeing skills on the Delaware River and drowned. And that moment really cut my mother's life in two. She met my father very much on the rebound and married another young man with an exotic past.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because Sergei plays a very important part. I mean, he stays, as it were, with the family for a very long time. He's very much a part of your family, though he perished in that canoe accident.
Yes, I like to think I grew up with Sergei Thomas, the man who almost married my mother. He is the reason my parents got together. My father heard about the death of this promising young man and wrote a condolence letter to my mother. He was very much a ghost in the household. I learned to play tennis using Sergei's tennis rackets, and I was a very serious tennis player. Somehow holding that handle was like holding Sergei's hand. And, you know, people who die young are all potential. So yeah. Sergei was a kind of what we would now, I guess, call a role model who was never diminished by real life. So, yes, Sergei was the ghost who haunted my youth and still very much haunts my life.
Well, all of these influences, and we'll sort of talk a little later on about how they all come together the best they can, but I want to find out about more family members and their relationship with North Carolina. Your aunt and uncle, who also escaped from Hitler's regime, found themselves in North Carolina. Tell us their story.
Yeah, every family is held together by stories, and one of the huge surprises for me in following my own family around in this family memoir was how many times different strands of the family showed up in the state of North Carolina. My father's aunt and uncle were the artists Joseph Albers and Annie Albers, very well-known figures from the design school in Berlin known as the Bauhaus. My great aunt Annie was of Jewish background. They had to get out too, and they were offered a job at this startup, experimental, innovative school in the mountains of North Carolina, just east of Asheville, Black Mountain College. And for the next 10 or 15 years, Black Mountain College was the most innovative school in the United States, just an extraordinary experiment in living and thinking and creating. Artists like Robert Rauschenberg and Cy Twombly studied at Black Mountain College. Buckminster Fuller came to erect his first geodesic dome at Black Mountain College. The dancer Merce Cunningham and the incredible composer John Cage were based at Black Mountain College. For a while, this tiny school of about 200 kids seemed like the epicenter of American culture. And my very dapper great uncle, Joseph Albers, who was best known for very austere squares within squares, his homage to the square, he was the impresario who ran this school. So my German-Jewish background and my rural North Carolina background crossed yet again in the mountains of North Carolina.
Yeah, and I guess it gets back to that the theory that you had about all anxieties, tensions, and violence leading to the impulse to create, to find something brand new.
I think that's right. I think what shook the country loose and made it possible to experiment in a new way with education was the Depression. It's one of the surprises in American educational history that a lot of the greatest experiments in progressive education happened during the 1930s when a lot of these scrappy startup schools like Bennington and Black Mountain College came into existence. People were really not afraid to try something new. They knew that the old stuff hadn't worked, and you know, starting from zero, as the Elberses like to put it, seemed like a pretty good educational strategy.
These are some theories that come together because of some very important and real historical events and tangible material. Real stuff like brick and clay also play an important part in your family story and the development of this memoir.
That's right. And one of the Elberses' experiments in their classroom and in their workshops was to start from zero and making bricks and in really finding the raw materials of weaving and pottery and so on. My memoir is partly a kind of a live archaeological dig, and the stuff that really interested me was the raw materials of the lives of these North Carolina relatives of mine. My mother's father was a bricklayer and brick maker in the Sanford area of North Carolina, which is still calls itself Brick City, USA. The Elberses were very involved in craft making, in weaving, and very interested in weaving traditions in the mountains of North Carolina. And then the last part of the book goes even farther back to the really unbelievable story of early American craftsmen looking for a really high-quality white clay in the Cherokee towns of far western North Carolina and willing to pay a lot of money to the Cherokee people to get that perfect clay as white as snow. And the way this book works, one of my relatives, the explorer and writer William Bartram, was involved in that search for a clay as white as snow.
And this talks about, gets us to the Jughead culture of North Carolina as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, exactly. Both Jugheads and Jug Towns. That's right. My mother grew up very near the folk pottery of Jugtown, which is in the Seagrove area, in the Piedmont of North Carolina. And a big part of the book really came together for me when I realized that the same clay beds where my grandfather was getting his bricks from were where the potters of Jugtown and Seagrove were getting the clay to make the really unbelievable pottery that they grew that they manufactured, and that handmade pottery from Jugtown was really my first artwork. Those were the first things, our sugar creamer, my little teacup, that really gave me a kind of aesthetic sense. But far to the west in North Carolina, where there was this really live folk tradition with head jugs and so on, all kinds of wild pottery forms. I think it's no secret that North Carolina is just a extraordinary culture in making pottery, and still is a very vivid local culture.
Well, I was thinking about the way things came together as well, because it was the North Carolina side of your family that was engaged in brick making. But when we go all the way back to, let's say, the Exodus and the Jewish side of your family, brick making, of course, is a very important part in the founding of the Hebrew people, and the story of the Exodus. Having to make your own bricks is what drives them across the Red Sea.
Exactly right. And another wonderful aspect of that is that the name Adam simply means made of clay. So both humans and human civilization seem deeply involved with bricks and brick making. It seems as though you can't be fully human without a culture of brick. And I thought I could build a whole book with a deep foundation of brick.
How much of the family story had you known before this student kind of sent you the picture and reminded you of your upbringing in Richmond, Indiana?
Bits and pieces, really fragments. And I think all of us grow up with these stories that seem partly real, partly dreamed by us, partly made up, and you find that different versions of them don't quite correspond. And my angelic messenger who walked into my office at Mount Holyoke to bring my past back to me made me want to know what was true and what wasn't quite so true. So in some ways, a book of memory turned into a book of archaeological digging as well. I mean, one of the I knew the contours of my mother's love affair with Sergei Thomas, but I didn't know what Sergei sounded like, what his voice sounded like. And I was doing research in the Guilford College Library in its Quaker collection of documents, and I asked a man there if he had any information on the camp for conscientious objectors in the Smoky Mountains that Sergei had served in. And he said, well, we've got mimeographed newsletters. And he brought out the trove of newsletters, and in every one of them, there was a column by Sergei Thomas, just speaking as though he were alive as you and me. And so there were many moments in researching the book where I just felt, oh my God, this person has come back to life for me.
Chris, a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
Chris Benthy is a professor of English at Mount Holyoke College. His new book is called Red Brick, Black Mountain, White Clay. He'll be at the Pottery Center in Seagrove, North Carolina, Saturday at 1:30. Also going to be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh, Sunday at 2 o'clock. That's the State of Things for today. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. Program directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blides, the intern, Robin Copley, our technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.